listening to the Daily Gold Podcast, covering precious metals, the junior mining sector, and global capital markets for intelligent investors. Now, here is your host, Jordan Roy Byrne.
And welcome back to the Daily Gold Podcast. You know, we haven't been doing that many Daily Gold Podcasts lately. Last person we spoke with was Greg Weldon around the beginning of the summer. He's our favorite guest. He's your favorite guest. That's why we have him back. Greg, there's so many things we could discuss, as always. But starting off here, I just want to get your general view on precious metals. Are you still constructive? Do you just see this as a correction and an uptrend or a bull market? Or is there something else at play here? Could the Fed be pausing after this cut that they're going to do? I know there's a lot to unpack there, but hopefully you can unpack a little bit of that.
Okay, well, really simply, yes, no, no, yes, yes, no, no. Is that good enough? No, I'm only kidding. Yeah, there is a ton of stuff to discuss. I think what's interesting to me is kind of something of a, gosh, I don't want to call it a bifurcation. It might be too strong a word. But, you know, you have this expectation that with the resolution of global trade conflict, which is still far from a given, but the market seems to want to move under the assumption that that is a given and that that's going to be a cure-all for what ails you. And what ails you is a really kind of a lack of a growth engine. And to think that trade and a resolution of the trade conflict is going to be an engine of global growth, I think, is a misplaced expectation. Now, the reason I say all that is twofold. Number one is the expectation itself is going to drive markets for a while, and that's going to be bullish for equities. I think it's going to be, you know, it's negative for the dollar because you have breakouts going on in other currencies, notably the renminbi, but really extending to the Sing dollar, the Taiwan dollar. You know, it's really seemingly heavy in Asia. I just finished a big special for my institutional clients on the Asian economy outside of China and Japan, and, you know, you have declining trade, you have declining retail sales, you have declining inflation. If the expectation is that a resolution to the trade conflict between the U.S. and China is going to boost global trade, is going to free up the flow of trade to the point where it generates income growth, which generates retail sales growth, which generates GDP growth, well, I think that's a bit of a stretch. But where you have here is a lack of inflation, the degree to which a lot of the central banks, particularly in Asia, but, you know, to a lesser degree in Europe, and certainly in the case of the U.S. and Canada and Australia, have room to cut rates. Bond yields have room to fall in many, many places. Take a place like Indonesia, for example. Okay, they, you know, their trade is down, their income is down, their GDP growth has slowed. And in the meantime now, you've got a bond market with about a 7.5% nominal yield against 3.4% inflation. That's a pretty fat yield when there's no yield to be found anywhere in the world, especially when you see a currency that is beginning to appreciate and potentially breaking out on a long-term basis. So that is all a lot that seems to be somewhat of, you know, some countervailing, conflicting winds, if you will. But at the end of the day, it's kind of like you have two things working for you here. An expectation that if not met, and it probably won't be, will spur central banks into action. So I think that creates a fertile background right now for gold. I think the dollar has peaked. I think that's the biggest thing going on right now. Is the breakdown in the dollar last week? And I think you must have a mole inside my organization, Jordan, because, you know, you call me to do an interview on the day that we bought back in. So, yes, we called the initial rally, I think, exceptionally well. Our buy-in point was between 1189, 1196 originally. We swapped into silver at just the right time, when it became a monetary move instead of a move in the dollar against all paper. Now, all of a sudden, the Fed's cutting rates. It became a U.S. monetary move. Now it's a dollar move, and we think silver will outperform. We bought silver this morning. We bought gold this morning. So And I think the risk reward, the stops are pretty tight here. I mean, you've had this really well-defined ABC correction, particularly in silver. You've hit the Fibonacci's. You've hit what I call the double kill zone, which is the zone between two of the major Fibonacci's, in this case, the 38 and 50% Fibonacci in silver, and two of the either medium-term moving averages or the long-term moving averages. And I use the same moving averages for every market. What I have learned over 35 years is to be robust, and you don't want to be fitting every little thing, every little nuance, because you want indicators that work, you know, over long periods of time in a lot of different markets, and it shows that they're robust. In this case, the 100 and 200-day exponential moving averages on the dailies, and then the 52-week and 2-year moving averages on the weeklies. These corrections, I mean, particularly in platinum, which came right to the point where it broke out, the neckline, the 50%, the 2-year moving average. I mean, this stuff, you couldn't almost draw it any better if you were teaching a seminar in Technical Analysis 101. Then you throw in the break in the dollar. Then you kind of throw in this thought process. You're going to have some rally in stocks that's predicated upon at least optimism around, you know, trade, you know, resuming its growth and, you know, backed by central banks, which in a lot of cases, and particularly in Asia, have a lot of room to cut rates. And that's a pretty good backdrop for gold. So we think the correction is actually over, and we're back in on the long side.
So do you think fundamentally that the rate cut story, that was the big driver, you see limited risk that there could be a pause there, or that maybe, you know, it stops for a while, like this is another 98 scenario. So you think that looking, I mean, of course, we're just projecting, but looking into next year, that there's still going to be multiple rate cuts?
Not necessarily. And that's what makes it really intriguing, interesting, and, you know, I mean, something that you really have to stay on your toes, because, you know, if the Fed is not going to cut rates again, wouldn't that be bearish for gold? Wouldn't that be bullish for the dollar? Well, the fact of the matter is, it's been the opposite throughout this entire kind of cycle. So not necessarily. But what I think you have going on here is, yes, the Fed probably backs away here. If you have an expectation that, okay, things in the current situation aren't that great because of tariffs and trade and the kind of the souring of psychology and confidence, then the outlook has been rosy. And we see that in stuff like the Philly Fed Index, for example, where the current conditions remain depressed, but the outlook all of a sudden is picking up and really starting to move to the upside. So you have that going on, number one. Number two, you have a core rate of inflation in the U.S. that's at 2.4 already. Okay, I mean, that seems to be lost on a lot of people. You have a headline rate of 1.7 that's going to jump to 2.4 and potentially higher come December, January, even into November a little bit, when you get the data for November in December, for December in January, and so on and so forth, because of energy. Last year, at this time, in the fourth quarter of last year, crude oil went from $76 to $42. All right, you have that calendar effect that's going to pass through into the CPI, PPI, all the data, the retail sales data even, you know, could be affected by this, let alone that you have situations in both gasoline and more so heating oil right now that are bullish fundamentally on their own merits for those two products. So if you were to build on and break out, you know, 197 in the nearby heating oil is a huge level for me. You have very low levels of distillates, and you just coming off the warmest summer ever. And what we have found is this is not necessarily that it's global warming, even though it is. The bigger picture is volatility in the weather. It's extremes. I mean, it's extreme storms. It's extreme drought. It's extreme floods. It's extreme heat. It's extreme cold. And if this pattern were to persist, you're looking at a potentially record cold winter, and you're not ready for that in terms of the inventories of both heating oil and, to a lesser extent, natural gas, which has rebuilt somewhat better than heating oil. But heating oil is actually very low. You're talking at big deficits in a year-over-year basis. You're going to need cold snap. You're going to jack the heating oil market. You know, gasoline's positioned already because you're trying to pump out more heating oil to kind of catch up on your supply build that you have failed to do. So now gasoline's all of a sudden in a more favorable position than it was just even 6 weeks ago. The point there is you could have an inflationary dynamic here in the next 3 to 6 months that puts the Fed back on their heels. But I don't think that's necessarily bearish for gold because, number one, I think that's, you know, it kind of sets up the dollar negatively. Let's not forget, I mean, you get a whiff of inflation. That's not necessarily the best thing for the currency. That's actually negative for the currency. So you could be in that vein. And if the Fed's not cutting rates, I don't necessarily think that's bearish for gold, because the thought process would be that this is a calendar effect, that is going to wear off. And when you come out of this six-month period, this could be like the emperor has no clothes denouement epiphany scenario, where all of a sudden inflation starts to retreat and people look up and guess what? Well, trade's back on track, but it's not the engine of global growth we thought it would be. Then the Fed's back in play. The dollar's already lower, and then you really get a nice move to the dollar downside. Gold is already kind of perked up here, and that's really well positioned to take off. And if you're not kind of maybe looking through some of this and getting in here, you know, I mean, we could be wrong. You know, it wouldn't be the first time, but I feel pretty confident that this setup is that if you kind of look through, you know, some of what might be perceived as being some roadblocks, you're going to find that we're very well positioned 3, 4, 5, 6 months from now by buying right here.
So you see the risk of higher inflation and higher inflation expectations as that's an immediate risk, but there's a question of 6 months from now how sustainable that is when some of these other things happen.
Yes, and I think, you know, you could even have a perception that, you know, some push in inflation here, you know, is linked to the perception that trade is going to be the fix-all for the economies and that the inflation is coming from the economy. If people aren't careful and don't really kind of do their homework and misunderstand a potential push in inflation here as being reflective of economic strength, I don't see how that's bearish for gold at all. I mean, I really don't. So, you know, to me, it kind of almost is a setup that probably shouldn't be bullish for gold, but is. And then it turns out that, oh, yeah, maybe it should have been because it wasn't sustainable, meaning, you know, the let's not forget, you had this big move in energy, 76 to $42. And then within, you know, that it was a six-month turnaround, 3 months down and then 3 months right back up. So this won't last. I mean, that inflation jig will rise, and it could lift inflation towards the three handle. So, you know, understanding that the Fed's not cutting rates if inflation has a three handle, all right, you could see bond yields rise here in the U.S., and I think that's another big trade, actually, is, you know, looking for currencies to buy outside the dollar, looking for bond markets to potentially sell against bond markets you potentially buy, and the U.S. would be one you'd probably be selling, and then, you know, being long gold and silver, and then you probably, frankly, this could be one of those times where stocks go up, but gold and silver go up too. We just had this period where the dollar went up and gold and silver went up, and you broke all the historical correlations there, right? And now you're kind of on the opposite side of that. And in that case, I don't see why you couldn't have a period here where stocks rally and gold actually, you know, does not necessarily get whacked on that, whereas that might normally be the case. You know, people are moving money into stocks and they're pulling out the safety assets. And that could be symptomatic of what's happening in bonds, but I think there's a different story there linked to all the things we're talking about with inflation and where the Fed may have to, you know, be on their heels a little bit here. But I don't think that prohibits gold from rallying, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the stock market because I want to bring that into it because I know you watch this all the time, but I'm always looking at gold against the stock market, gold stocks against the stock market. And you, I mean, we talked about this like a year ago and you correctly said that they both, you know, you weren't concerned about the relationship there, that, you know, gold and gold stocks can do really well. They don't need the stock market to go lower. But I just look at specifically the gold to the S&P 500 ratio, and, you know, gold's come up to a, I think there's like a 2 or 3 year trend line resistance there, maybe 4 year trend line resistance. I think we need to see gold really clear that ratio for it to be able to make a huge move higher. Maybe you disagree. I mean, do you agree with that? And if that doesn't happen, then what kind of upside do you see gold and gold stocks having if they go up at the same time as the stock market?
Yeah, I do agree with what you're saying. And I think that that actually sets you up beautifully for the kind of scenario we just talked about 6 months from now, 7 months from now. I mean, you know, gosh forbid, you know, with refis and whatnot, that the consumer can continue to borrow, which I think is a big question mark. And ultimately, one of the major speed bumps, if not roadblocks, to, you know, a longer term economic growth story. But that all plays out to where you kind of rally with stocks. And then when the next phase comes, that's when gold breaks out against stocks, and that's when the bigger more, you know, vociferous upside moves take place. This may be kind of a lull to sleep type of rally here. You know, I don't know if it's going to go straight up unless the dollar really cracks open, but that's hard to see how that's going to play out if the Fed's not cutting rates and the stock market's rallying. Now, you have to keep in mind that amid all of this, we have other central banks in play, and we have other currencies in play, too. So, you know, to me, that's always a thing we want to keep in mind. And when I look at Asia, I see a lot of places where you have central banks that could cut rates. I mean, the Bank of Thailand, for example, cut rates in August. They undid a rate hike they had just implemented a few months before. Not only that, but you got fiscal stimulus from the Thai government. And this is all based on the Bank of the BOT and their statement. This is based on the fact that exports are falling. And you can link exports directly. It is a direct overlay in all of Asia, particularly true in Singapore, Thailand, and Korea. These three places, even Indonesia, very clear. Taiwan's another one. Those five places in particular. When exports down equals retail sales down equals GDP growth slows equals, you know, bond yields down, which puts pressure on the central banks there. So, and I think, you know, in a place where central banks are cutting rates and potentially having a lift from, you know, a recovery at least in exports, that doesn't hurt the currency. So these currencies could move too. So this is kind of a case in point where, you know, you have to keep in mind you're going to have central banks that are cutting rates, that this inflation dynamic is a U.S. issue. You know, it'll be an issue in other places, but not as much. And I think the degree to which it doesn't prohibit central banks in those places from supporting whatever recovery you might get in exports from acting. So that all kind of mitigates some of what you might say, well, if stocks are rallying, that can't be good for gold. I think you have a situation there, number one. And then number two, in that same vein, as you're seeing other central banks still in play, and, you know, you see the ECB still in play to the degree that they're throwing the ball to the EU Commission and saying, you guys got to, you know, come with fiscal stimulus. There was another big country, I forget which one it was, that just published a report about how fiscal stimulus should be automated based on certain statistics in, you know, in terms of growth. And if you lose growth impetus, you automatically get a stabilizer effect out of fiscal stimulus. This is becoming a more and more discussed and potentially accepted dynamic too. So you could see a wave of global fiscal stimulus at the same time. And then the other part of this is when you look at the big, big picture, when we step back from trying to look at what's going to happen in 3 months, 6 months, even 12 months, and we understand the secular dynamics around the trend from 1971 to where we are now, and how central banks are just papering and papering and papering to historic levels. It's never been greater in terms of the debasement of the purchasing power of paper. And this will continue. And this is something that the public has caught on to. This is something that has the public concerned. And this is something that is going to make it, you know, make the public much stickier in terms of holding their gold and silver mining shares and stuff like this. So, again, I think there's insulation from where you might have rotation out of the metals into, you know, some of this stuff. Tech isn't really all that attractive right here if they're going to be regulated. So that's a big thing. The consumer, huge questions. Not providing the kind of leadership they have in the past, riddled with debt to the point where, okay, it's great that the Fed cut rates, but guess what? Credit card borrowing costs didn't come down that much, maybe 15 basis points relative to 50 basis points of rate cuts. Still 17% is the average credit card rate now in the U.S., up from 11 a few years back. So I think the consumer is not providing the leadership. The tech is at risk here. So who's going to run around dumping their gold and silver shares to, you know, plow back into the stock market when they really what they see, what they feel, what they perceive? I hear this from questions from people a lot wealthier than I am. All right. You know, do I need protection here? Can they keep doing this? You know, at what point, you know, does this become, you know, bad for all paper currencies? And I think the experience of 2019 has shown us we're there. Because over 2019, gold has appreciated in every single paper currency on the planet.
Right, yeah, and that's something, especially gold going up with the dollar, that's something that, maybe you could speak on that just for a minute. I mean, it's surprising because nobody really expected that. I mean, we've seen times where the dollar can go, let's say it can go sideways and gold can go up or hold up well, but we actually, I mean, over an extended period beyond a couple months, that's something we've seen over the last 12 months or so, is the dollar going up gold going up with the dollar. I mean, that's just been really amazing if you think about it.
Well, it's funny you say no one really expected that, but that's exactly what we expected. This is exactly what we talked about last August. I did a couple of TV gigs, and we certainly were on your program here, your podcast, and it was talking about how keep an eye on what we call, and I know you look at it in the opposite, but we're looking at the same thing, what I call the gold-adjusted value of the dollar index. We saw this coming because you could see the break in the historical relationship in that ratio. Same thing that you look at. You look at, you know, the gold divided by the dollar. So, you know, in that vein, you could see the depreciation in the dollar starting long before the Fed even went to a neutral bias, you know, because they went too far in December. And guess what? The dollar reacted to that. And, you know, it's interesting to kind of see this goes back to last August. And I remember the piece I did, I think it was August 29th of last year. So we're talking now, what, 14 months ago? And it was specific to this thing. And we called it paper burning. And the idea here was that you were going into a mode here where the next round of central bank cuts that would ultimately come from the Fed when they probably went a bridge too far, which is exactly how it played out into the fall, into December. And then we said they're going to have to backpedal and get to neutral, and then it'll give us an easing bias, and then it'll finally cut rates some point in the second half of 2019. That's exactly how this all played out. And we said over that course of this time, it's going to become increasingly, glaringly obvious to, you know, Ma and Pa Kettle, you know, the average Joe, you know, Joe Q Public, if you will, Jane Q Public, Jane Doe, however you want to, you know, put that in terms of kind of the common man, so to speak. Even at that level, it's now recognizable that central banks are devaluing the purchasing power of their money in paper form. And that's, you know, we saw the theme. We saw the action, and when I saw the gold-adjusted value of the dollar index, which is simply the DX divided by gold, it's not rocket science. But when we saw this break down from the uptrend that's been in place since the crisis, it was screaming to me that you were going to diverge and de-link from the dollar, and that gold could go up in lieu of the dollar not going down. And that's exactly how it's played out. And it will continue to play out that way in my mind because, as you know, and as anyone probably that's listening to your podcast is interested enough to listen to your podcast knows, since 1971, the dollar has always been the relief valve. And since 1971, the purchasing power of the dollar in gold is down 88%. And that doesn't mean it can't go down another 88% in the next 10 years. And that's, to me, what is most likely. And that's where the big picture for gold is, and that is where you get back to the common man kind of seeing this and saying, look, I'm not getting sucked back into equities here when central banks are going to have to print, what, $8 trillion in the U.S. next time we have an issue? They're going to be able to get away with that. They're going to have the stomach for that. There's going to be the political will for that. I highly doubt it. So, you know, that's the day when you really want to be owning gold, when all of a sudden it's like, guess what? They can't continue to boost this just by printing more paper money. And that's going to be the, you know, the big day for gold. But that's probably still, you know, I mean, maybe even a whole cycle out. So still a kind of a 3 to 5 year game plan.
Okay, Greg, just I want to finish on a couple of questions on stocks. I want to go back to what you were saying about, you know, gold stocks. Talk to us about that juicy long-term base in GDX, that resistance at 3132 that goes back 6 or 7 years or so. And then you have GDXJ, which has basically done the same thing, although it's a little bit weaker. I mean, talk to us about the potential for some huge moves higher there, what kind of time frame we're looking at, and if, you know, how long a potential breakout move there could last, if it's like a 1 or 2 year thing or a 6 or 9 month move. How do you see that playing out?
Well, the first thing I would say would be that here's kind of where you're almost can create a scenario. And again, this is kind of what we do, and this is what I learned, you know, working with Lewis Bacon and Moore Capital back in the 90s. I mean, you know, what we used to just love to do, and even a commodity corp with some of the most brilliant minds in the business. This is how, you know, this is where I learned from guys like this, you know, and Lewis Bacon, one of the greatest traders, you know, that's ever lived. And what he was great at doing is what I love to do and what I do to this day and what we're doing right now, which is sit around, discuss all the various scenarios. Well, what if this happens? Well, how about if this plays out? Well, what if this were to come to fruition? And then what would happen? And this way, when you kind of see one of those scenarios that you've discussed start to develop, you already have an idea of why it might be happening and what you want to do. So I'll throw one of those at you right now. In the sweet spot here where equities, you know, don't look so bad, and certainly in places other than the U.S., they look a lot better. France, number one, a place like Taiwan, number two, and even Korea, which has gotten decimated. The KOSPI's breaking out here, too, on a, you know, breaking out through the 52-week and the downtrend line since the trade war started 12 months ago. So in that vein, all right, and in the vein of, well, you know, you're going to have some global central banks providing liquidity, you're going to have fiscal stimulus, you know, you have this kind of still a free flow to some degree of capital. At the same time, when even if bond yields go up a little bit, they're still ridiculously low relative to any other type of, you know, funding, financing, however you want to look at it. The sweet spot for mining equities would be, guess what, if, oh my gosh, gasp, you could bring back mergers and acquisitions, investment. And I think that this is something that we've seen the first wave of it, certainly with, you know, some of the stuff that, you know, ABX has done and Newmont and whatnot. But I think there is much more of that to come. You know, you know, is probably better than I do even, how almost, you know, underinvested this entire sector, the mining, the actual physical business of mining, you know, metal has been, to where, you know, I mean, gosh, it's not that long ago. They're canceling conferences and nobody can raise money anymore. And why are we don't have anyone sponsoring because there's no capital out there. Well, I could see a situation where you're kind of starting to see it in nickel because of the EV, you know, that's a electronic vehicle battery, you know, a big component, 80% of the lithium battery is made of nickel sulfate. So you're starting to see some of the, you know, penny stocks in Australia, all right, being bought up because the expectation is, you got resource in the ground. We don't care if you can't get it out and you don't have the financing and the money. The big behemoth is going to come in and take care of that for you and buy you out at a really rich price. I could see this kind of scenario where this next wave of stock market to the upside actually benefits the mining shares in the sense that it creates a little bit of merger fever, kind of takeover fever. I could see that being really bullish for these shares to where, you know, the resources in the ground get revalued and all of a sudden you have a lifting of the entire sector to a kind of a higher level, you know. On the other hand, you know, is it energy where we're going to stay underinvested and no one wants to own it forever? No, I don't see it playing out that way. Energy is a totally different story when you start to talk about alternative energies, when you start to talk about, you know, the surpluses, when you start to talk about all the things that are not what we see in mining in the energy space. So, you know, that's a question I get a lot when I go on this kind of thought process, but you can't link the two right now. And I think that's a big plus in the context of rising equity markets that we haven't seen for, you know, gosh, for the better part of a decade, at least, if not longer.
So, yeah, just to close, Greg, it sounds like you think, you know, hard assets, not just gold, but energy and also some of the industrial commodities, that could be an area where that really benefits from a potential upside move in the stock market, because these investors, they've made a lot of money in tech, and, you know, tech, like you said, it could be regulated. It's really overvalued. So is that, I mean, I'll just mention, I don't know who it was this summer, but I saw an article that said that mining, not just gold, but gold being a small part of mining, the overall mining space was like at the cheapest chiller cape ratio. I think it said in like 100 years or something, or the second cheapest in the last 100 years or something like that. I mean, pretty ridiculous. So it sounds like you're optimistic on not just gold, but also the potential for hard assets to have a lift here.
Yeah, hard, and I would even kind of couch that with a tongue-in-cheek and saying soft assets, meaning soft tropical commodities and the ags. And I just did a big four-part special on all of the commodity sector last week, and if your listeners want to get it, they can shoot me an email. But the first part of it was actually on the agricultural commodities. You know, let's not forget, I mean, in my mind, the dollar has made a significant crack here. And, you know, if you get below 95.50, it's going to 88 and then potentially lower. That is going to be a big benefit to some of the commodities that are the most depressed out there. Soybeans, sugar, coffee, cotton. You want one that's kind of industrial and ag. Cotton's a great example. We got bullish cotton last week. It's already popped. The spreads are widening. It's kind of, you know, the fundamental situation. The most recent world agricultural supply and demand estimates from the USDA just literally 10 days ago, maybe. It was the 9th, I think. Man, that was really exciting because for the first time you saw some improvement in cotton supply-demand fundamentals. And these are markets too. Sugar and cotton are two great examples. Soybeans is another one. These three markets have, I would say, I hesitate to use the word dramatic, but it's almost a usable word in this case, in more so and maybe in soybeans than the other two commodities, cotton and sugar. But you are in a much better supply-demand situation now than you were 2 years ago in all three of those commodities. And yet prices are dramatically, dramatically lower than they were 2 years ago. That's when I see things like that, that's just something that's out of whack. And when you come to a realization point, which is not that far away, I think, in soybeans, I think, you know, you're really kind of almost there in soybeans. I mean, this crop in the U.S. was devastated, and the yields are going to be lower, and I still don't think that the damage assessment is even complete. And, you know, and it was already expected to be a lower crop, all right? So that's 2 years now, a lower crop. But what's more important is you have no margin for error in some of these commodities. Sugar is one of them. Soybeans is a big one of them where, you know, just because you've had bumper crops, which have disguised the fact, and no one talks about the fact, that demand is at records too. Is Chinese demand for soybeans and soybean meal going to be a little bit, is the growth going to be lower than last year? Yes, it is. You have some animal issues, or, you know, certainly the trade war, but that's, the trade war is temporary, and they've been buying through Argentina anyway. So, you know, they found a way around this to some degree that's not visible in the numbers. But what you know, yeah, people saying, well, you know, it's going to be a slowdown in the demand side. It's not a slowdown in the demand side. It's a slowdown in the growth in the demand side because demand is at a record every single year. And now you're running 2 years in a row where supply is less than demand. So this now is whittling off what it had been 2 years ago, pretty big inventories of stuff like soybeans, even more so corn on the ground. And, you know, there's a lifeline on that, too. There's a, you know, shelf life and something like that as well. So I think some of the agricultural commodities, really well positioned, something we're focused on in our daily research and in our money management business. And certainly we'd welcome any of your listeners to, you know, come to our website and, you know, get involved, because I think some of the biggest opportunities are in all these commodities, not just the precious metals, but certainly in some of the other commodities. Nickel is one of them we mentioned already. Zinc is also another one of them in the metal space. I think heating oil right now, we're long. Gasoline sets up well for the spring. And then you have a whole host of the ag, soft tropical commodities that are already in play with real solid upside potential and great risk-reward math here because they're so depressed.
Greg, as we close, yeah, please tell our audience about your product offerings. I know you have several, including the Gold Guru, which is a new one. Yeah, please tell us about those offerings and where we can go to get more info and subscribe.
Sure. We got three basic services, so to speak, that we offer to the public. Number one is, you know, a little higher price. It is the Weldon Live. It's a daily product where we cover foreign exchange, fixed income, global stock indexes and ETFs, precious industrial metals, all the ags, all the energies. We have trades in the futures markets, the ETFs and the equities in all of those sectors. We track them with stops and the whole nine yards. That is the Weldon Live. That's one product. The second product is Gold-Guru. So it's gold, you know, draw the dash, not the word, guru, G-U-R-U, goldguru.com. That's a new one, and that came about through need. I mean, we get, you know, people that kind of come to us from you, and they can't afford the higher-priced research and, you know, have questions about, you know, I mean, how do we do this? Why I started, you know, did the whole Gold Investor Boot Camp, which is also available on that website, goldguru.com, gold-guru.com. Which basically walks you, it's a four-part series, walks you through everything you need to know to trade, invest in, buy the coins, buy the bars, trade the futures, manage a portfolio, risk reward, per trade risk, leverage, all of that. Because people, I mean, I think the futures markets are a really untapped resource for people to use. And if you can't use the futures resources, you have ETFs, and, you know, that's another great way. And, of course, we follow all the equities in the mining space in goldguru.com. And then, of course, I am a CTA, and we do manage money. We have a pretty high minimum, $500,000 minimum, but that's because, you know, we are very risk averse, and I really like to, you know, hold the risk down. And these markets are very risky. I mean, with $500,000, I buy one contract of gold, that's nominally worth, you know, $150,000. So, I mean, you know, if you have $150,000 in your trading account, you know, I mean, you can manage that, but, you know, it's tight, man. So we do the CTA business, you know, money management, but really very few select clients that, you know, understand the risk involved because, you know, we're not out there hunting for 8%. We're out there hunting for 25%. And with that comes a commensurate amount of risk. You can be found there. The Money Management and the Weldon Live are Weldon Online, one word, WeldonOnline.com. And, of course, the Gold Guru is only $60 a month. If you sign up for a year, you get 2 months free. And I think, man, that's tremendous value. I almost feel guilty like I'm giving it away. But at any rate, gold-guru, that's gold-guru.com.
Okay, Greg, thanks so much. I always love having you on, as do our listeners. And, yeah, thanks so much for your great insight. And we'll have to check back with you again over the months ahead to see if anything's changed.
Yeah, my pleasure, Jordan. You did a great job, too. So my hat's off to you.
Thank you for tuning into the Daily Gold Podcast. For more interviews, editorials, and analysis, log on to thedailygold.com. And for premium coverage of precious metals and the best junior mining companies, visit thedailygold.com/premium.